Good evening. Good to be back with you tonight. Thank you so much for coming. And I'm, again, glad to have my wife, Jamie, with me. Tonight, I would like to try to drive home an important lesson, a lesson that believers ought to meditate on or think about, I think, quite often in our Christian lives. I'm calling it the ripple effect, and I'm thinking back to when I was a boy and I periodically was taken near bodies of water, and I had this inexorable urge. I mean, it was just indefinable that I just had to pick up stones and throw them in the water. And now I have grandchildren, and we walk them by a rock river in Watertown, and sure enough, they want to empty all the stones on the bank down into the water. And generally, you're trying to skip stones. You're looking for flat ones, and you're doing that number. But sometimes you just want a big stone and see how far you can throw it, and then watch it splash and ripple. And that ripple effect, which we're all familiar with then, is how one little thing can have impact that is unanticipated. If you've, you know, my wife and I love to go, we periodically go to a camp in central Wisconsin called Camp Fairwood, and they have Pleasant Lake next to it, and we love to get on the canoe and go out on Pleasant Lake. And it's very pleasant, except when the motorboats are going by, you know, and then all of a sudden your canoe is doing this, you know, and there's ripple effect. There are a whole lot of people in church history about which we know a whole lot less than we would like. That is, I like to tell you the story of a Charles Spurgeon or an Adoniram Judson or a William Carey, where you just can't pack all the information into the available time. But then there's a whole bunch of people out there that are significant, and yet most of the details are lost to time. And yet, they had an effect. Their obedience, their faithfulness, their willingness to sacrifice for truth had an impact. And I think it's important for us to understand that, well, this morning, one of our lessons was duties are ours, events, consequences, results are God's. And so I obey today. And it seems like nobody notices, nobody cares, and I've got my own little small chunk of the universe that I'm operating in, and if I were, you know, sucked out of it, who would notice? Now, I'm not wanting you to replay It's a Wonderful Life in your head, but there's an important theme there in that it doesn't matter whether anybody would notice. If I'm being obedient to God in that, He's the one who can take that and He can multiply it like Christ did the bread and the fish. So my theme verse, which I have to say a couple of things about, comes from Zechariah chapter 4. This is a very encouraging chapter. Most people are familiar with back in verse 6, which is not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. Well, what is it that's not by might nor by power, but by my spirit? Well, the great work that Zechariah and Haggai were called to preach. And they were preaching to the small company that had returned from Babylonian exile with Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel and the priest Joshua. And they had been back for about 20 years, and they had not rebuilt the temple. And Yahweh was unhappy about that. He says, you guys are back. Rebuild my house. Now, probably the reason they had not dived in to rebuild this building was because the older members could remember the temple. It was one of the most spectacular buildings ever built. I mean, there was gold and silver and precious stones everywhere, and it was magnificent. And now there are these poor, beleaguered returnees from exile, and they're looking around going, well, we're not going to be able to build that, so why bother building anything? And Haggai and Zechariah get up and say, listen, it's not by your might, it's not by your power, it's by the Spirit of God. So get busy and build the temple. And they laid the foundation. And do you remember the passage in Nehemiah where half the people are weeping and half the people are rejoicing because the older are saying, oh, wow, this is not the temple I remember. And the young people are saying, praise God, we've got a temple. And it's in that context that Zechariah prophesies, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto you, for who hath despised the day of small things? God's not dependent on our numbers and our power and our ability and our accomplishments. He gets the job done. That was the theme this morning in a personal sense relative to sanctification. Well, the theme tonight is be faithful to put your little pebble in the lake and let God take care of the ripples. The two stories I would like to tell you are about Henry Dunster and Elias Keach, two American Baptists. Now, if you were in Sunday school, and I know a few of you were, not all of you, in Sunday school, I told the stories of two Anabaptist martyrs, Felix Mons and Michael Sotler, and because the two men were contemporaries, I kind of wove their stories in and out, possibly confusingly, but I felt like as contemporaries it was better to do it that way. Well, these men are not contemporaries exactly. They're both 18th century Baptists, but in fact, Dunster is going to die 8 years before Keach is born. So I'm going to tell you Dunster's story, and then I'm going to tell you Keach's story. The linkage between these two very diverse stories is that in surprising ways, these two men are going to have a profound impact on American Baptist church history. And yet you wouldn't have known that at the time. Now that is, who would have guessed the impact they would have? All right, so the story of Henry Dunster. And again, in the case of these men, there is so much that we don't know compared to what we do know. I wish we knew a lot more detail. We know that Dunster was born in England. I wish I could tell you the exact town. We do know the day because we have records of his birth registry and the parish church. It was near Cambridge where he went to school. And by 1634, at the age of 25, he had a master's degree. That wasn't exceptional. But on the way there, two things had happened. He had become one of the recognized experts in England in the Hebrew language. That is, he just mastered it. Some people take to Hebrew. It's hard. And one of my sons has just taken to it. He loves Hebrew. And he's just eating it up. And I can't talk to him anymore. You know, I mean, he's over there. But he just loves the language. I have to tell you something humorous that happened with him. There's kind of a star Hebrew teacher at the school where he is, and my son hasn't had the chance to have him for classes. In fact, my son's done now. He finished his THM in December. But he liked to kind of rub shoulders with this guy, and one day they just ran into each other after lunch, and this teacher said, "So Shane, what did you have for lunch?" But he asked him the question in Hebrew. So out comes a Hebrew question. And Shane knows the Hebrew word for chicken. Well, this teacher happens to be a Hispanic man. And Shane says, "So I was going to impress him by responding with the Hebrew word for chicken. And I opened my mouth and out came pollo," which is the Spanish word for chicken. And the teacher says, "Yeah, I get that a lot." So. But Dunster had become one of the outstanding Hebrew scholars in England. But the other thing that had happened to him as he's going through his education was he had embraced Puritanism. And in the 1630s, the Puritans were being persecuted by the English government. That is, King Charles I, his Archbishop William Laud, had no patience with the Puritans at all, and they were being arrested one after another, and thousands of them are getting away from Charles and Laud by sailing across the Atlantic to America. In fact, 1629, 1630, the Great Migration begins, and New England, the Massachusetts Bay Company has started. So when he graduates with his master's degree, his abilities, his accomplishments, his knowledge meant that he should have been able to get a plum job in England. But he was a Puritan, and Puritans were not getting those kinds of preferments at the time. Now, surprisingly, he landed as the headmaster of one of the notable, what we would call high school, a preparatory academy in the Cambridge area. It was actually a remarkably good job for a Puritan. That shows how much everybody respected him. But it was way below what one would have expected. At about this time, over in America, a new school was started called Harvard. The occasion for it starting was that the Puritans there were concerned that they were having to send their sons across the Atlantic Ocean to study at Oxford or Cambridge for the ministry. They were afraid that their sons would not come back. And they also weren't sure that over in Oxford and Cambridge they would get the Puritan theology that they wanted them to have. So they decided they would start their own school. A young man, a very young man by the name of John Harvard, took half of his money and his entire library and donated it to Harvard, so they named the school after him. And they found a headmaster by the name of Nathaniel Eaton. Well, Eaton ended up being a very poor choice. He was ill-equipped to carry out the mandate of Harvard, which I'm sure you've read, but I think it's worth noting when you think about where Harvard is today. Their mission statement was, after God had carried us safe to New England, and by the way, the spelling here is original, and we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government. One of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity. Why? Dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. And as we were thinking and consulting how to effect this great work, it pleased God to stir up the heart of one Mr. Harvard, a godly gentleman and a lover of learning then living amongst us, to give one half of his estate, it being in all about 1,700 pounds, towards the erecting of a college and all his library. After him, another gave 300 pounds. Others after them cast in more, and the public hand of the state added the rest. That would be taxes. The college was by common consent appointed to be at Cambridge, which was a suburb of Boston, a place very pleasant and accommodate, and is called, according to the name of the first founder, Harvard College. So Harvard was established to train preachers. That's not what they're doing now. I mean, there's a Harvard Divinity School, but you don't want to go to their churches. Well, Nathaniel Eaton, this first headmaster, is a train wreck. That is, he's harsh with the students. He doesn't teach well. And by 1639, after 3 years, they fire him and say, well, we need a better headmaster than Nathaniel Eaton. Now, if there is correspondence with England about this situation, it has not survived. What we do know is that Dunster resigned from his position at the school and decided that he wanted to be a true Puritan. He didn't want to have to conform to the state church anymore. And he got on a boat and crossed the Atlantic and arrived in America in 1640, which was perfect timing. He's 30 years old. He's going to turn 31 shortly after arriving. That's a little young to run a college. But he's got all the capacities. And so they ask him if he would be the head of Harvard. He said, well, I have one issue that I think you better be aware of. The word baptizo and the cognate in the Septuagint, bapto, those words mean to dip or immerse. They don't mean sprinkle or pour. And so I'm a little concerned that we baptize, supposedly, by sprinkling and pouring. That's not the early church usage, and it's not the meaning of the word. And they said, well, do you accept infant baptism and our entire covenant theological scheme? And he says, oh, well, of course I do. I just think we ought to be immersing the babies. And they said, well, it's New England. These moms are not going to let you immerse their babies. You know, down baby, up popsicle. It's just not happening. And he said, well, that's okay. You know, I was working with it in England. I can work with it here. And he became President Dunster. He's regarded as the very first president of Harvard College. Eaton had never been given that role. He had built up something of a fortune in England. He was financially pretty set. So he actually purchased property adjoining the school, built a house on it, which became the president's mansion, and donated the whole thing to the school. He obtained a printing press, which he put in the basement of the house he built, and he began printing curricula for the school. You've got to understand, when we say a college, we don't mean a faculty of 47. Eaton was running the school, and now Dunster is running the school, and he's teaching all the classes. I mean, it's a small student body, and he works with each of the young men individually, and he teaches them the languages, and he teaches them theology, and he teaches them church history. And he's an expert teacher. They establish a chapel, and he preaches in the chapel, and he's a solid preacher. And across New England, people begin to think of Dunster as like the finest scholar we have. Wow, this guy is top notch. And he has come over to be with us in rugged New England, where, you know, we have Indian troubles and we live hand to mouth pretty much. Dunster was happy to be there. And from 1640 until 1651, he brought to Harvard a significant reputation, and he became the answer man. That is, if there was a theological difficulty, if you weren't sure how to handle a problem with a verse in the Hebrew or the Aramaic or intertestamental or whatever it was, you wrote to Dunster and he'd figure it out for you. I mean, he was just brilliant. And there were a lot of sharp Puritans, you know, some really godly men and women, Shepherd and Cotton and a number of others. But Dunster sort of was head and shoulders above them all in scholarship. He is honored today as the founder and first true president of Harvard. Now, a humorous thing about how he's honored is nobody knows what he looks like, and so they have a statue on campus labeled Henry Dunster, although it's known that that statue is not of Henry Dunster. You know, it's like they wanted a statue, and so they put one up of somebody else. In 1651, something happened to really shake up Dunster. A pastor from down in Newport, Rhode Island, by the name of Obadiah Holmes, he was actually a deacon at the time under his pastor, John Clark. They had come up into Massachusetts and held an illegal church service. But there was a Baptist in Massachusetts who had asked them to come, and they did it privately in the man's living room, and nobody should have been the wiser, but somebody ratted him out, and the Puritans, rather than just allowing them to have their church service and go home, arrested them, put them on trial, fined them, and if they wouldn't pay the fine, they were to be whipped. Holmes received a brutal, brutal whipping. Couldn't lie on his back for months. It was a horrible thing. And Dunster saw it. And Dunster began to say, this man is suffering for belief in believers' baptism. I'm going to look into that. He was already aware that baptizo means immerse. All he needed was, remember this, some of you will remember, this morning I talked about how you figure out who and then you figure out how when it's baptism. You figure out who should be baptized and you figure out how they should be baptized. Dunster is an unusual exception to that rule, in which he had already determined that the mode ought to be immersion, but he still believed in infant baptism. And after seeing Holmes whipped for denying infant baptism, he began to study it. And 2 years later, that is, he wasn't in a huge hurry here. This was not some precipitous, unthought-out action. I mean, he's an esteemed member of the community. He's a college president. He's going to take his time. But he studied out the question in great detail. And in 1653, he announced in his classes and in the chapel at church at the school that infant baptism is not scriptural. That we have built it on a faulty foundation. We have equated it with circumcision. It doesn't have the same function as circumcision, and therefore we should not be doing this to babies. He proceeded to preach a sermon series in which he proved it from church history, from the original languages, and from sound New Testament theology. About that time, his wife was giving birth to their third or fourth baby. We're not sure if it was the third or the fourth, but it had to be one or the other. And he said, this baby's not going to be baptized in the Cambridge Parish Church because that wouldn't be baptism. Well, the authorities are now facing a difficult situation. The foremost theological expert in the biblical languages is essentially teaching Baptist theology. Those despised crazy people down in Rhode Island, John Clark and Roger Williams and all those people that we think are nuts, our greatest scholar agrees with them. They did not know what to do with him. Of course, at first, They put together a delegation of pastors, the leading pastors of New England, and they met with Dunster, and they presented all their Reformed theology, and Dunster just destroyed it. I mean, he knew more than they did. But he knew there would be repercussions, and there were. They were not going to leave the college which was training the next generation of pastors in the hands of a Baptist. And so they fired him. They said, "You are to resign." They then seized his land and house and moved the new president into them and kicked him out of Cambridge. Then they brought him up for church discipline. And at the discipline, he refused to budge. That is, he was convinced of his position. And then he said, "If I'm disciplined out of the church, then I'm leaving." And he picked up his family and he moved to Plymouth Colony. Now, Plymouth Colony was filled with separatists, but these separatists were also baby baptizers. And so he didn't really fit in there either. I can't tell you why he didn't move to Rhode Island. I wish he had. It would make the story make more sense. He never formally joined a Baptist church, and there were some available. There was the Baptist Church of Providence. There was a Baptist Church in Newport. I wish he had gone to Rhode Island and joined one of those churches. He didn't. And by not going out of Plymouth, he was subject to harassment for the rest of his life. That is, the authorities came after him over and over again. In 1657, 4 years later, they pull him before a grand jury and insist. They were embarrassed that anybody who was questioning Puritan theology could look at Dunster and see, like, Exhibit A. But they could never get him to back down. But they harassed him to death. I mean, they didn't kill him, but they put pressure on him continuously. And in 1659, he passed away at the age of 49. Well, the Baptists down in Rhode Island were rejoicing in his courageous stand for the truth. Dunster, however, died not really thinking he had done much. I mean, he took a stand, but all it really did was cost him his job. Don't know what happened to his kids. I wish I could tell you. I didn't even know the name of his wife. But there was a man in Cambridge, a businessman by the name of Thomas Gould. And Gould met with Dunster, and Dunster taught him his theology. And Gould, as his wife started having babies, refused to bring them for baptism. And he came up for church discipline. And they kicked him out of the church. But he had a successful business, and he wouldn't leave the community. And by this time, the authorities are not exactly doing everything the pastors tell them to. So Gould's allowed to survive there in Boston. And he starts convincing his neighbors of his theology. And they establish, essentially, a little Baptist church in the middle of Boston. Well, they're persecuted. They have to cross over to Breed's Hill for a while, and every member of the church spends time in jail. But 3 years after Gould's death, they established First Baptist Church of Boston, which is there to this day. One of the members of that church was a businessman who had come over from England named William Screven. Screven decides to take his business up to Maine. He's persecuted there for being a Baptist, and he decides... He takes his business to Maine and then starts a church. And as a businessman, he pastors this church because there's nobody else there to do it. Wins people to Christ, and people who don't like the Puritans join his church. And after they persecute him for a while, he says, "You know, I don't have to be in Maine." And he and almost his whole church sailed down the coast and established First Baptist Church of Charleston, South Carolina. Well, the First Baptist Church of Charleston is going to plant several more churches down in along the estuary there near Charleston. And when Baptists explode across the South, First Baptist is going to emerge as the leading Baptist church throughout the entire South. The pastor of the church, Richard Furman, is going to be the most significant Baptist in the South, and he's going to be elected the first president of the First Baptist National Organization. One could suggest that Furman is president of the Triennial Convention because Henry Dunster said, "You know, the Bible doesn't teach infant baptism. I'm going to take a stand on that." Of course, there's always more factors, but you just never know where the ripple is going to go. All right, so the first president of Harvard ended up being a Baptist. And I think that's a great thing. Well, the other man I would like to tell you about is Elias Keach, and I'll call his story Playing with a Lion. You'll see why. Keach was born 8 years after Dunster's death. If Dunster had not died at such a young age, these men might have had a chance to meet. He was born in Buckinghamshire, which is right in the heart of England, and his dad was Benjamin Keach. Now, that name may not mean anything to you. Maybe someday I'll get a chance to tell you Benjamin Keach's story. He was a man who got saved and became a Baptist, a General Baptist, that is an Arminian Baptist, and then he moved to London and met the Calvinistic Baptist there, and they won him over to their position. He became a particular Baptist. He started a new church on Horsleydown Street in London, and he's going to pastor that church for over 30 years, and it's going to become one of the leading Baptist churches in England. Keach is going to become arguably the greatest Baptist theologian of the 17th century. Brilliant man. He's also the Baptist who introduced corporate song singing to Baptists. That is, Baptists were skeptical. I'm sorry, I can't get caught up in this. But Baptists were skeptical of corporate singing because the way they did it in the Anglican and Lutheran and Catholic churches was all high oratorios and the people were just spectators. And so there was virtually no music in the Baptist churches. And Keach came along and said, man, we ought to be a singing people. And he started writing songs and compiling hymn books. And he convinced his church over about 10 years to embrace corporate music. And then it just spread across England. And it helped that while he was trying to convince them to embrace music, Isaac Watts started writing hymns. And all of a sudden you've got all these great hymns to sing. Well, Elias is growing up in this home. And he does not like it. He doesn't like being a preacher's kid. He doesn't like living in a fishbowl. He doesn't like having everything he does scrutinized by a congregation and by other people in England. And so he decides that he's going to escape. And he gets a job as a teenager and saves up enough money that at the age of 19, he leaves. He gets on a ship and he sails to America. His goal? Get away from the name Keach. I'm going to have my own life, and Dad and his religion can be on the other side of the ocean. He lands in New York Harbor, crosses Raritan Valley, gets in the Philadelphia area. He's moving away from the Baptists because the Baptists are all in Rhode Island, you know, a church in Massachusetts, but not very many. He gets to the Philadelphia area, and he discovers that a bunch of Scotch-Irish Baptists who have no official connection with those Rhode Island Baptists have migrated the Philadelphia area and are meeting in these little cells, but they don't have any pastors. They're just getting together and they're encouraging one another and they're reading the Bible together, but they're not doing ordinances. There was only one Baptist church at the time in the whole area from these Scotch-Irish, and it was further north. And so he meets these people and they say, "What's your name?" And he makes a critical error. He says, "I'm Elias Keach." They say, "Are you related to the great Benjamin Keach, the theologian? We've read everything." He said, "Oh, no, yeah, that would be my dad." And then they said, "We'd like you to be our pastor. Surely you could preach for us." Now, we have this story on very early and solid authority. He says, "Yeah, I'll do that." He thought it would be fun. Why not? I know my dad's sermons. I've heard them 100 times. Here is the earliest account of the key moment. He performed well enough. That's interesting language, isn't it? He performed well enough till he advanced pretty far in his sermon. It sounds like his first sermon, but it maybe was a later sermon. We're not sure. Then stopping short, looked like a man astonished. The audience concluded he had been seized with a sudden disorder, that he was having a seizure. But on asking what the matter was, received from him a confession of the imposture with tears in his eyes and much trembling. Great was his distress, though it ended happily, for from this time he dated his conversion. He got saved in the middle of his own sermon. He was handling the Word of God. He was playing with a lion. Well, Cold Spring Baptist Church, Cold Spring, Pennsylvania, to the north, was pastored by a man named Thomas Dungan, and Keach went up to Dungan and received believer's baptism by immersion, and then Dungan instructed him. Now, he had been in his dad's home, but Dungan made sure that he understood pastoral ministry, and in 1688, 2 years after he had fled England, so he's now 21, he goes back down into the Philadelphia area to an area called Pennypeck. Today, it's called Penny Pack, and it is a neighborhood in Philadelphia. Philadelphia grew and grew and grew and swallowed it up. He organized those Scotch-Irish settlers into what is the oldest Baptist church in Pennsylvania. That is, it still has survived to this day. But he wasn't satisfied to pastor that little group of Scotch-Irish settlers. He started traveling all around the Philadelphia area and over into New Jersey in the Raritan Valley, winning people to Christ, telling his story, preaching the gospel, and winning people to Christ and organizing them into little churches. Pretty soon, he had started five of them. Five churches made up of mostly Scotch-Irish settlers who all wanted to worship according to the Baptist pattern. And he was their pastor. He was all they had, and so he pastored them on a circuit, like a circuit-riding preacher of 100 years later. Well, I would like to tell you that he continued in that circuit for the rest of his life. That would be more edifying. Fact is, after pastoring the Pennypeck Church for 4 years, he got into a dispute with the deacon board. That is, they wanted something that he didn't like, and they were arguing with each other. And finally, he decided that, I think the Lord might be calling me back to London. And he left in 1692 and went back to London. But that meant he was reunited with his dad. And that was a sweet thing. He started a Baptist church in London, and his preaching was astonishingly used of God. By this time, William and Mary have been installed as the rulers in England, and William has put forward the Bill of Rights and the Act of Toleration that says there will be no more persecution of Protestants. And so Baptists, for the first time in their history, are meeting free of official opposition. And his church, we're told, that the crowds, at least, not members, but the crowds grew to over 1,500 people gathering in London to hear Elias Keach preach. He collaborated with his dad. They took the great London Confession that had been published in 1688, and they adjusted it to add singing of hymns, and they made one or two other little adjustments, and created what later is going to be the Philadelphia Association Confession. And then at the peak of his ministry, he got tuberculosis and died at the age of 34, and he was in heaven. You say, well, I could see that he had a lot of influence in England. No, those five little flocks over in Philadelphia, they started meeting together for encouragement and praying that the Lord would send them pastors. And pastors started arriving, some from the old world who are Scotch-Irish and some from the Baptists over in Rhode Island who were organizing. And as they started to organize, they began meeting together every third year for mutual fellowship. And after doing that for a few years, in 1707, they banded together officially as the Philadelphia Association of Baptist Churches. That association, and by the way, Baptists are going to love associating. By 1814, there's going to be 48 of these associations all over America. And when they all merge, they'll form the Triennial Convention that Furman was the president of. But the very first of these associations was the one that came out of Keach's efforts. The influence was amazing. That is, everybody thought the center of Baptist life would be Rhode Island, because that's where Roger Williams and John Clark were. But it shifted to Philadelphia. And Philadelphia became the heart of Baptist life. 1742, the Philadelphia Association adopted the Keach Confession and called it the Philadelphia Confession of Faith, which is an outstanding Baptist confession and was used by hundreds of churches over the next 50 years. You just never know when you're a teenager getting on a boat to sail away what God's going to do. All right, that is, he transformed American Baptist history through this young Elias Keach. So, what are you and I doing today? What you and I are doing, this is a statement rather than a question, will have effects tomorrow. This is, in fact, a principle that's all through the Bible. What a man sows, that we also reap. So what are we sowing? Do you have any questions about these two vignettes? Much shorter than what I usually do, but we don't know a whole lot about these men. Yes, sir, Frenchie.
Did Elias teach change his name when he was doing that thing in Philadelphia?
He should have. Well, see, he told them he was a Keech.
There was a weird name, Morgan.
Oh, Morgan Edwards was the historian that recorded that account. He's the historian that we have the account from. So I was attributing the quote to him. Sorry, that wasn't clear. All right. Yes, sir, Captain. Well, of the original 48, they weren't always precisely on state lines. So like the second one was the Charleston Association, 1751, and that was just the downstate of South Carolina. The third one was in the middle of North Carolina, the Sandy Creek Association, and it extended up into Virginia and the Carolinas. And then it got so big it split into three. And that's what happened. Baptists would want to get together for fellowship and mutual encouragement and to help each other evangelize and support mission. But as they became bigger and people had to travel further to the meetings, they would split off and form their own association. And so a handful of associations get more and more and more and more and more. But when the Judsons went to India and then Burma as missionaries, and Luther Rice came home and said, "You Baptists need to support them," none of the individual associations felt like they could afford it. And so Rice makes this whirlwind tour of basically all the associations saying, "Are you interested in helping?" And everybody said, "Yes, yes, 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 yes." And pretty soon they all decide to meet together in Philadelphia, which was where they had their first meeting, and vote all the independent associations. Well, I don't know that they voted them out of existence, but they essentially merged them into the Triennial Convention that met every 3 years. And it became the first national organization for Baptists. It's going to split in the 1840s because of slavery into the Southern Baptist Convention and the Northern American Baptist Missionary Union. So Baptists love associating. The idea of a church that has no connection with other churches was unknown before about the middle of the 20th century. On the other hand, these associations were very careful to not give the association any power over the churches. The churches are absolutely autonomous. The only power we have is that if you cease being Baptist, we can kick you out. But we can't tell you what to do in your churches. They were fierce about that. All right, well, I hope this theme is an encouragement to you. I hope you will not despise the day of small things. Never allow yourself to think that what your little obedience doesn't matter, because who will that affect? God's the one who brings the effects. And they're often way beyond what we could have imagined. Thank you, Lord, for the opportunity to discuss Dunster and Keach, these two men that are not really as significant to Baptist history in some ways as the Roger Williamses and the Charles Spurgeons. And yet, Lord, you did remarkable things through them, just because they were willing to submit to the authority of your word. I pray that you'd help us to have submissive hearts, and that in our small spheres of influence, maybe a housewife who feels like she's only influencing her three children, Lord, only eternity will show the impact of her faithfulness in rearing those children for Christ. I pray that all of us will be faithful in that way. And thank you, Lord, that the ripple effects can only be measured in eternity by an infinitely sovereign mind. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.